But if you have this crystal clear image of what your life wants to be, and you can feel it, like, I want my life to be like that, and you have a plan for how you use technology to make your life like that, and that plan doesn't involve Twitter, now it's much easier to not be using Twitter, because what you're doing is not just trying to stay away from something bad. You're instead trying to pursue something very appealing. And that's a much more stronger psychological motivator. It unlocks everything. We underestimated, especially for young people who've had social media since they were, you know, in their young adolescence, we underestimated the importance of reflection. So time alone with our own thoughts is where we make sense of our life. It's where we confront the things we don't like. And it's where we try to make sense of the things that resonate and figure out why they resonate. It's where we build this structure for understanding our life, who we are, and what we're trying to do, that we keep updating and complicating as we have new experiences and new information. And all of this takes mental time. It just takes time when you're on a walk and you're thinking, you're driving and you're thinking, you're waiting in line and you're thinking. And it's where we begin to build our lives. And we build who we are. We figure out what we want. We see the challenges we need to face. This gets taken away when you get in the habit of, I don't like being alone with my own thoughts. I don't like boredom. Swipe, you know, ooh, that's a little uncomfortable. Tap. When we do that, we lose all of that time we need to define ourselves, figure out our lives, and figure out what we're all about. And so it's almost as if for a lot of people, they are able to emerge into a fully formed personhood for the first time once they take this out of their life as a constant presence. What you have when you're taking every down moment and using this phone is, what you have is this sort of weird, shattered simulacrum of a personhood, where it's just a bunch of these liquid images of yourself, different impressions, careful curation, all based off of this sort of tactile feedback of likes and unlikes and retweets and unretweets and attacks or promotions and what emojis are being used and how is this being received. And it's this weird fragmented self that has no depth to it, that's not rooted on anything. And you can't build a resilient life on that. You can't build a meaningful life on that. And when you replace that with thought and you figure out yourself and what you're all about, it's a completely different experience of the world. It's like you're coming from 2D into 3D. That is what it feels like when they get their mind back and they get more used to their mind, the good, the bad, the stuff they're afraid of, the stuff they're proud of, and they figure that all out. You can't get around that. You can't distract your way around that. We do that with our phone today. In other parts of history, we've done it with other substances. You can't avoid yourself, what's going on, what you like, what you don't like. It's in the confrontation of that that you actually build the meaningful life. And it requires you to put these things in their place. I'm Cal Newport. I'm a computer science professor who also writes about the intersection of technology and culture. We simplify too much. We simplify too much the path towards work that you're really passionate about. It's more complicated than that. The advice really that people are giving is, follow the goal of ending up passionate about your work, because it's great to be passionate about your work, and to not be makes everything much more difficult. But it got condensed to follow your passion. And the issue with that, I pointed out, was it presupposes that everyone's wired to do something, and that the primary action necessary to unlock passion for your work is to match your work to this pre-existing trait. So it's all a match game. You were wired inside to be a writer of advice books. So all that matters is you figure that out, and then you'll be passionate. And when I look back at the research, it's more complicated. That passion tends 9 times out of 10 to cultivate over time. The initial match, like what I do, is important, but it is just one step. There might be many, many different paths that can lead you to passion. So, you know, pick one that's reasonable. What's important is what you do once you pick one. In the moment, what you're doing is, what is something I can do that is available to me, that works with sort of existing skills or talents I already have, and crucially, will open up more interesting opportunities if and when I get good at it. Now, there is going to be a lot of things that probably satisfy those criteria in a lot of people's lives. Don't sweat which one you choose. Take one of those and then focus on, let me now go all in on this. Over time, passion begins to grow. Commitment to that work begins to grow, the meaning begins to grow, and shifting the mindset away from the passion exists entirely in the beginning, so you just have to find the right job to unlock it, versus passion is something that you have to very carefully grow over time, so that 5 years from now, 10 years from now, you're really loving where you are. It's a more realistic assessment of how it works. It's not about, I'm meant to do this, so let me figure that out in advance and go after it. It's, you know, here is something that is interestingly, let me go after this interesting thing passionately and then see what comes next. And so then people said, well, how do I get really good at things? And a big part of that answer was deep work. Deep work is just my term for where you are concentrating without distraction on a cognitively demanding task. You're giving some of your full attention. But that without distraction piece is a key attribute of the definition. Without distraction means no context shifting. And this is something that a lot of people don't realize, and it causes a lot of issues in terms of actually trying to do cognitive work, which is, we know multitasking is bad. If I'm working on editing a documentary or writing an article, I'm not going to keep my email inbox open while I'm doing it, or I'm not going to be on a phone call while I'm trying to write. I can't actually do both. We all recognize that, and we basically don't do that anymore. What we don't realize for the most part, however, is that when you do a quick check of something, so you have to glance at email, you have to glance at Slack, you glance at what's going on social media on your phone, and then come back to the main thing, there is a long after effect of that quick check. It could last 10 or 15 minutes after that check happens. What happens from a neurological perspective is that we're slow to completely change our cognitive context. So when we see something that's highly salient, like a emotionally affecting social media post or emails, that we need to get back to these people eventually, but we can't get back to them right now, but we know they're waiting for something, it initiates a context shift in the brain. There's networks that are being inhibited, other networks that are being amplified. So we start this expensive context shift, and these can take a long time to actually finish. We don't let it finish because we're just glancing. Then we come back to editing the documentary or working on our article, and now we're trying to abort that context shift and then get our brain back to the context of what we're working on. And so what we end up with is this collision of initiated, aborted, initiated context shifts, the effect of which is cognitive capacity reduces, cognitive fatigue raises, and the background hum of anxiety is enhanced. So what is happening right now to a lot of people who are doing high-level knowledge work is that they think they're editing a documentary full-time, they think they're writing an article full-time, because these quick checks of email and Slack and their phone, they only take 30 seconds, and they don't have it open at the same time. But each of those quick checks is leaving this residue. And before that residue can clear, which might take 15 minutes before you're fully back in the context of the work, you check it again. And then you check it again. And so we're putting ourselves in this self-enforced state of reduced cognitive capacity. It feels terrible and we're exhausted. So deep work is, I'm not only focusing on something hard, I'm doing it for an extended amount of time with none of those context shifts. I'm basically avoiding those things that brings down my capacity so I can actually operate at high capacity. And I think it's a critical behavior for success in any sort of non-trivial knowledge work, is the ability to give each thing attention until you reach a stopping point. So it can be your full cognitive context is the thing you're working on. This is how you unlock the full potential of your brain, avoid fatigue, avoid anxiety. One thing at a time, giving each thing its attention due, not having this background interleaved concurrent quick checks of all these channels simultaneously. I think that is the key, the satisfaction actually producing stuff that you're proud of. And the idea is you take your work hours and you give every minute a job. So you say, here's my time available. Okay, here's meetings and calls. What am I doing with all the other time? I'm making a plan for that in advance. And we call it blocking because you have these columns with the hours on the rows. You're drawing blocks, like this 30 minutes I'm working on this, this 90 minute. You draw the block and you label it. There's a couple things that really help here. One is it puts you in the sequential mindset. I'm doing one thing at a time until I'm done, then I'm moving on to the next. So yeah, I need to do email, but there better be a block for that. And when I get to that block, I can do email. But right now I'm in the block for writing. So that's what I'm doing. I'm writing. So it puts you into a sequential mode. Two, it allows you to actually move around the chess pieces here on the proverbial chessboard of your time and be like, what's the best way to make use of the day in front of me? You know, I'm going to be packed in the afternoon, so I better get after it real early to try to get this thing done. And there's only a 30-minute block between these two meetings, so why don't I wait till that block, the follow-up on X, Y, and Z, which is pretty low energy, but it needs to get done. You're being much more intentional. So when you care about what you do with your day, you're going to get a lot more out of it. And then there's this ancillary third benefit is you learn, because you make these blocks, you make these plans. If you're new to it, your plan's going to explode. Why? Because everyone thinks that things take 50% less than they actually do. So you begin to pick up over time as you have to fix these time block plans again and again, concrete visceral feedback on how long things actually take, how much time things actually take. And this leads to a lot of positive developments. A, you start on things earlier because now you feel in your bones how much time it actually takes to get this done. And B, you begin to cull back your schedule. You have a much better understanding of, well, how much is really on my plate? If I'm doing this, this, and this, and now that I know how big those blocks are and how hard they're to fit them in, I realize it's not all going to work. So I need to stop doing this, hand this off to someone else, and delay this for another month. You begin to be able to make data-driven decisions about what's on your plate. So there's like a lot of good secondary benefits that all come from this primary commitment. Let me actually give every minute of my day a job in advance, as opposed to the alternative, which I call the list-based reactive method, which is in between things that are on your calendar, you react to things that come in over email and Slack and then see if you can make some progress on some sort of to-do list. It's a 2 to 3x times difference in terms of how much you get done if you time block versus the list reactive method. Fix when you want to work and then work backwards from that to say, okay, what can I fit into there? It's a really great way to do it because you are then in control of, you know, how much time you work, but it's surprising what you can do, how it sharpens the mind, how it sharpens your priorities, what you say no to, what you'd say yes to. And it's a really fantastic approach as you fix in advance, this is when I want to work, and then ask, all right, now what? Well, there's anxiety that comes with not shutting down because our brain obviously is worried about what David Allen would call open loops. There's things that I'm responsible for or I need to do and I haven't. If that's just being kept track of in your brain, it drains your energy and makes you anxious. So to me, a good shutdown routine is one that is focused on exactly one thing, ensuring that there is no open loops. There is nothing that your brain has to keep track of in the evening. And so for me, a shutdown routine is what I'm going to do is all of the different inboxes. So email inboxes, but physical inboxes. My planner has pages every day for like capturing things that need to get processed. I make sure all of that gets moved into my task systems. It's written down. It's somewhere it's going to be seen. I look at it every day. I check my calendar. I check my plan for the next day. It's really a process of telling your brain, there is nothing right now that's a problem that we have to work on tonight. There's nothing right now that we missed that is going to need a response or that we might forget about. It's all written down in places where we can trust. Then I'm going to do this shutdown check. Now, the way this works is then later, when you're new to this, what's going to happen is your brain is still going to say, oh, I'm worried about this, I'm worried about that. And your temptation will be like, well, let me convince my brain and go through, no, I checked that, I checked this, don't worry about it. But that kind of keeps the loops alive. If you've checked off this box that says shutdown complete or said a phrase like shutdown complete, all you have to tell your brain is, I checked that box, I said that phrase, and I would not have done that if I was not satisfied that there's nothing I need to worry about tonight. So it's a way of calming your brain without actually engaging in a discussion about the particular work things that it's worried about. You do this for a week or two, your brain stops trying to bring you into that discussion. It becomes just a natural physiological reaction, check, check, stress fall. And so it's a fantastic way to actually reclaim your evenings away from work, to put that anxiety aside, to let your mind be a lot more present. And procrastination is an interesting one. There's different aspects to it, and I don't know all of them, but there's two aspects I'd like to point out. So there's just a pure energy aspect. So the reason why very little good gets done in the office from 2 to 5, for example, is that you've exhausted your brain from the context shifts. Your brain is just crying uncle at that point. I can't sit down and do this hard thing. I'm out of fuel. So there's an energy piece to it. Another twist on procrastination that I've been looking into off and on, and I think is interesting to keep in mind, is if we're talking about a big project, you're just not getting going on it. And a lot of this came out of, by the way, my work I used to do with students. Sometimes what's going on here is that your mind doesn't trust your plan. So I just want to throw that angle in there as well. One of the defining features of the human brain, one of the reasons that we can separate from other animals, is that the human brain can both conceive of plans, right? So abstractly conceive of a plan and then evaluate that plan. Is it good or bad? And if it's good, you feel motivation to do it. And if it's bad, you feel dismotivation, right? So this is very important. Some procrastination is basically your brain rejecting your plan. I think when people take on ambitious projects, which I think is good, But if you haven't actually done the work of figuring out how that type of project actually unfolds, what's really needed to succeed, your brain knows, look, you don't have a plan here that I trust that's going to lead us to success. So no, I'm not going to give you motivation to do this. And it's why there's a lot of novels that last three chapters before people give up. It's because they got excited about the idea of writing a novel, but didn't actually do the work of figuring out what would it really take to break into the world of novel writing. They just want to do their 1,000 words in the morning and feel motivated and post it on Instagram. Their brain's not tricked. It's like, I don't see a plan here that makes sense. I'm not going to invest energy if I don't see a plan I trust. So I think that's a big part of it as well. Your brain is smarter than you think, which is sort of an ironic statement. If it doesn't really think you have a good plan that's going to achieve something worth achieving, you're not going to feel very motivated. That can feel a lot like procrastination. When you feel like a difficult action is being undertaken because you chose to, you can tolerate that difficulty much better than if you feel like you were forced into it, or it was someone else's decision. And now you're facing difficulty. We feel this intuitively, right? If you're doing something that's hard and it really wasn't your choice to be doing it, we get incredibly frustrated. So you have to drive across town to pick something up. You don't want to do it. Really, someone kind of dropped the ball and they were like, you have to, you know, they forgot something and now you have to return and whatever, go back to your kid's school or something to pick something up, and you get stuck in traffic. It's like much more frustrating than I'm going across town to get to the gym. I have, you know, part of my workout routine. You're frustrated about the traffic, but your just hardship was based on something you're doing, you know, you chose to do. Or, you know, similarly, you go through an elite military training. You chose to do it. You're doing it for a really good reason. You can put up with all the hardship and pain of it. Because we can do very hard things, but the rationale really matters, you know. So it's not, hard work is not just we have some a certain amount of substance to spend and who cares how we spend it. No, no. The amount we have, the energy we have to spend on hard tasks is very, very influenced by why we're doing the hard task. And so it's a hack in some sense, but also I think it's much more fundamental. People who do really hard things, you better believe they're tapping from that reserve of, these are things I chose to do for good reasons. Because if it feels extrinsic, I'm making my parents happy, or my boss put this on me and I don't even know why I'm doing it, you have way less to deal, way less energy to draw from. There's a wrong motivation and a right motivation. So you're actually right. It is, you need to feel as if you are the autonomous author of what it is you study. And it could end up being the same thing your parents want you to study, but you have to get there on your own. That's what matters, especially at that early level, because 19-year-olds are not wired for a particular liberal arts major that happens to be available. There's no genetic marker that pushes us towards mathematics versus economics versus English. That's not really the issue here. It's motivation. If you feel like I want to make this a part of my life, I've chosen to go in it, I know it's going to be hard, I'm surrounding myself with it, I'm reading books about it, I'm going talks to it, I love the challenge of trying to develop this intellectual expertise. I don't know if you're wired for that or not, but if you have that right motivation, you're going to be much more successful than if you come into it with, I don't know, my parents want me to be a doctor, so I guess I'll do pre-med. Now, work is going to be hard, almost by definition. You will occasionally get into a flow state, and that's great when you do. But flow states are rare. Flow states tend to be more in a performative state than in a skill acquisition state. So at some points when you're applying your skill, you can fall into a flow state. But actually a lot of what you do in work is actually building skills or honing skills or trying to make decisions, none of which is going to put you in a flow state that's pleasant. So I think it's really important to understand that work is work. It's often going to feel hard. So what matters is you're motivated to keep going. You know, lifting weights, heavy weights is hard. But if you're a professional athlete, you don't read it as hard in the sense of, I wish I wasn't doing this. You read it as, I love the burn I'm feeling because it means I'm going after the thing that I care about. This burn means my muscle's going to get bigger and I'm going to throw that fastball faster. That's the mindset we want in work. Like, yeah, this is hard. I have to master this new whatever skill. I have to master this new software so we can produce this better video or something like this. And you're like, yeah, that's hard in the moment, but I like this hardness because it's part of this vision I have for building this particular artistic vision. So I'm glad that it's hardness that provides satisfaction. So I do not like slogans like, you know, follow your passion, never work a day in your life. I think instead, your goal is to build a working life that you can pursue with passion. That can be a source of passion, can be a source of meaning, can be a source of resilience. And this is something that is a multi-year project, if not a lifetime project. It's about how you approach your work. not how you find your work. This is the way you should think about it. And so don't conceive of yourself as being wired to do this job. And if you match that job, you're set. Conceive of yourself as you're trying to build this masterwork that is your professional life, and you're building it on the fly, you know, as you live. And it's going to be hard and wonderful and rewarding, and over time get better and more nuanced and more resilient. But it's all about focusing on things you think that matter, doing them really well, taking that skill, the leverage that gives you, and saying what comes next and apply it. And then repeat, 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 constantly driving the structure you're building on the fly towards places that resonate and away from things that don't. Some days are going to be harder than others. Some places are going to be easier than others. Some things are going to be more successful than others. But over time, this is going to take you somewhere worth going.